Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with professional adventurer and guide, knife designer and survival expert, Joe Flowers. In the world of wilderness survival, Joe is known as one of the world's greatest jungle guides and survival instructors. And in the knife world, he's known for his robust, efficient, and quite handsome working designs with Condor, Tops, and now CJRB. I've wanted to talk to Joe for some time now, not only to adventure vicariously through him, but to talk about his designs, which seem inspired by traditional tools while maintaining a modern appeal. Joe's just recently back from another voyage to the Amazon, and I can't wait to hear about it. But first, like, comment, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and download the show to your favorite podcast app. Also, if you think what we do here is valuable, go check us out on Patreon, see what we have to offer there. Between giveaways and stickers and exclusive content, that's the most interesting stuff. Not to mention you can win a knife every month. It's a good thing to do. So go check us out on Patreon. That's theknifejunkie.com/Patreon. Again, for supporting the show, that's theknifejunkie.com/Patreon.
The Get Upside app is your way to get cash back on your gas purchases. Get Upside is an app you put on your smartphone, and whenever you need to get gas, search your area for savings, claim your discount, fill up your tank, and then take a picture of the receipt with your phone. And that's it. You've just got cash back. Visit theknifejunkie.com/save on gas to get the app and start saving. Again, that's theknifejunkie.com/save on gas.
Visit the Knife Junkie at theknifejunkie.com to catch all of our podcast episodes, videos, photos, and more.
Joe, welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, sir. Good to have you.
Hey, thank you so much for that very warm introduction. Definitely not an expert, because that means I'm done learning. And as far as one of the best survival jungle guides, I don't know about that, because the guys I train with, you know, their five-year-olds can outperform me.
Well, so, let's talk about that. You're humble bragging, or just being humble, I should say. But you're just back from the jungle, and I want to know what that's like. I see the pictures, but what's it like being there?
So I kind of just got back, like maybe Friday night, there, and so I still have, you know, different cuts and things that affect you out there. But the jungle is just so rich in resources all around, especially if you have tools that you can use to manipulate the environment around you, which is, you know, a quintessential thing for bushcraft. And man, it's just like being at a grocery store. There's paracord on the trees, there's different types of wood for you to carve and actually really use your knife, you know, for a reason, and have all of these different skills that you can learn more about yourself with. The place is just immersion central for that.
You said actually using your knife. So when you're out in the jungle, what's it like when you go down there? Are you living with people in primitive areas? Are you camping out alone?
So the traditional bushcraft global trip that I've started with my friend Tanaboka Knives consists of 2 days of like acclimation on our natural reserve, where you get like the slow-mo jungle instead of, hey guys, here's a whole bucket of National Geographic, you know, dumped on you. And you sleep in beds. We go on night hikes to show you some of the dangerous things. Then by like the third day, you know, it changes every year, but by the third day, then we take our kits on our backs and go to the jungle and just do a lot of crafting, hunting, primitive skills, culture sharing with like 6 different tribes for like 6 to 7 days, just depending on the season and what's going on. And then come back, have a big party, do some tourism stuff for 2 days, and then come back home. But it can be as hardcore as you want it to be, or we can, you know, tone it down and make it really easy for somebody so you don't have to be a tough mutter.
What is crafting?
So you're making stuff down there. It can be anything from slingshots to forks to kuksas, which are types of cups, all the way to bows that you have to make that are small. But that basically you have to go use for hunting later on. So you make these small little palm bows, and then you're able to go, you think you're making them for a kid, but no, you're going out and hunting for big fish that night. And it's really fun and intuitive too.
Wait, what did you call them? A palm bow?
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I have one here. So there's a rich history of different types of palms that are out there, and this one would be black palm. Okay. So it's a really, really, it's actually used in knife handles a lot too.
Oh. So you make a small bow and you go fishing with it.
Yeah. Or, you know, sometimes we'll dive into the lake and get clay from the bottom of the lake, bring it back up and make our own slingshot balls to fish with. Or we'll mount them on a slingshot. So you're doing sling bows, because it's actually almost easier to make the arrows for that than to fire the slingshot bows, or to fire your own clay balls. So yeah, you get to do all sorts of fun stuff. Trapping, basket making. This was a basket that was made on one of the trips. Yeah. This one's really elaborate though. This one's actually used for sifting flour. But yeah, so there's a lot of knife work, and you know, sometimes we do things where the different tribesmen will go, you know, hunting for different types of animals. This is like a blowgun kit that they would take with them, and in there is their Bic lighter, which is this basically, and this, which is fire by friction, and poison blowgun spikes, and they'll go out foraging for animals. And we can watch, you know, depending on which tribe it is. And yeah, it's really, really cool.
So these are some very primitive, I mean, this is more like primitive culture stuff than mm-hmm. it is primitive survival. I mean, obviously survival is kind of baked into it, but it's going beyond when you're building beautiful, intricate flour sifting baskets like that. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And no matter what, I mean, you're doing a lot of cultural immersion, but you're also, you know, doing a lot of foraging with your bare hands, you know, spear fishing, different types of trapping, things along that line too. So there is a survival aspect. And man, our last trip was one of the most dangerous animal rich areas that I've ever seen. You know, there were big spiders everywhere, and we saw lots of snakes for once. We never see snakes, but we saw like six by the third day there. But you know, after the first day, everything kind of leaves and you're good to go.
Intuitively, I would think snakes are everywhere in an environment like this. But also, you said big spiders. How big?
Spiders as big as your hand.
Oh.
But most of them are friendly. You know, they're, some aggressive ones, but they do have that banana spider there, the one that's mythical.
I will remain blissfully unaware. No, I'm just kidding. What is the banana? But what is the banana spider?
What is it where you have the same problem with Viagra? I think it's called priapsis for like 24 hours if you get bit by one.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
So they're actually researching it for Viagra and stuff too. But yeah, those are all over the dang place.
Wow, man. Jeez. Well, I mean, you could wander into the jungle and end up having a good time, you know, without even knowing it, you know.
Yeah. But, well, you know, that's we all – so there's this guy, Tanaboka Knives, who lives down there, and I actually have some of his knives here. Got one of the old school ones and one of the new ones. He's like my business partner down there. This is a Tops Tanaboka Puko, pretty popular right now.
Okay, so I recognized his name when you said it a couple of times, but that's why. Okay.
Yeah, so I kind of got him linked up with Tops to start making some of his designs, and there might be some other companies later. But this is some of his original stuff that you don't see.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's really cool and jungly. Check out that sheath.
Oh, that is cool. And the sheath is like a, it's bamboo,
black
right?
Palm. This is the same stuff you make some of the bows out of, black palm.
Oh, okay. And what's the handle made out of on that knife?
This is a type of bamboo that's actually indigenous to a bunch of different continents. I have the name written down somewhere, but, it's just bamboo that's really solid.
It's very interesting with those tiny segments.
Yeah.
So in your experience, how important would you say creativity is in staying alive in the jungle?
Man, I mean, I think that's important, you know, anywhere, not even in a survival scenario. Creativity is important at work. Creativity is important everywhere. There's so much life down there that everybody becomes very creative with just things as simple as a plastic bag or a plastic bottle, like Grim Survival's plastic bottle cordage maker. And, you know, when you're more innovative and have a, I guess, a creative skill set, you're able to, think outside the box and maybe survive a little bit better. And that increases your survivability anywhere, even at the workplace, I guess.
Yeah. What was that cordage thing you were talking about when you were holding up the bottle?
So let's see if I got one here on the table. Got it. This is Grim Survival Cards. And so he's got these dog tag cordage making devices. And there's a way you can actually do that with your knife. Creek Stewart talks about it in his Survival Hacks book. But this one actually makes cordage out of bottles. So yeah, it's really cool. Grim Survival does a lot of this, you know, improvised stuff. This is one of the cards that I did with them, based on a lot of primitive skills stuff that I've learned. And when you give these to like someone like the Matisse tribe or something, they can do anything with it. They can take a broken piece of glass and, you know, be able to gut an electric eel. So it's really fascinating to see them work with like high quality tools and cool knives.
So the tool set on your card here, it looks like a spearhead for spear fishing, maybe. It looks like a Warncliffe blade. And what else is on there?
So there's a tick puller. Nothing original there. That's just one of those flat card tick pullers. If you look down here at the bottom, this is a scoop that we would use for scooping out divots and bowls. It works okay. You have to like really slowly bend it around like a branch or like a battery. But the Matisse like to use it flat to scrape bows. This is kind of neat. This is based off of a shark tooth. Right here, a shark tooth drill to make, you know, small holes and things like trap triggers. And then this guy, this spear, took a little bit of finagling. It works a lot better than it used to because the barb would rip out of this stuff. But you don't really get a chance to test that stuff until you give it to somebody who's good with it. You know, I'm okay, but, you know, some of the tribesmen who I work with, even the modern guys, can still shish kebab a fish way better than I can.
Tell me about this. You call them Matisse tribe. Is it Matisse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Matisse.
So where not exactly, but where are they? And tell me about this tribe and how they live.
Sure. So if you look at National Geographic magazine, you'll sometimes see a Matisse on the front cover. They were first contacted in 1975. And then, became more or less contacted in the later, 1979-ish era. They've done a really good job keeping their culture the same. And, we talk to them. We have different tribesmen who come, before the time of, clothes, for instance. You ask them about clothes and they're like, man, we would put them in the hut and say, why would they wear these? It smells so bad. And so they'll tell you stories about that. And then we have a few other different tribes, but the Matisse are like the old school OG guys.
Do they remain that way today? I mean, in terms of clothes and everything, are they walking around in their very, very traditional garb, or have they adopted some of the Western?
They do both. You know, we try to ask them to remain in their tradition. We don't have to ask them, honestly. They're very proud. They put on shirts to go to, you know, town, and put on hats to go to town to keep them protected from the sun. But when they're in canopy, they just have their traditional like t-shirt style garbs and stuff. It's not like super religious, but they like to wear it when you first meet, and they'll keep it, you know, on them for most of the time. I wear some of that, you know, around my neck, too, but they also, you know, won't have the bones in their nose all the time because it's uncomfortable. They wear pants and shorts now. And, you know, sometimes they'll be wearing watches and things. It might be upside down and not working, but they'll still wear it. They're still pretty traditional. And, if they get cold, they'll put on a sweatshirt, you know, just like anybody else now.
Have you brought them modern knives?
And
what kind of blades were they working with, before you brought them modern knives or your knives?
So, you know, they're working with a lot of your traditional Tremontina style machetes, which would be like 1075 high carbon steel. And then, you know, a lot of just broken butcher knives and thing, which is like a low grade 420 HC or J2 or something like that. So they're used to stuff that they can manipulate. And so they're, you know, always grinding and making it a little better. And so it sucks when you bring like a $300 knife and Alberto the Yukuna can like out carve you with his broken butcher knife because they're really good at it. But so they started seeing some more of the high carbon stuff when I started working with them and were kind of impressed with edge retention. You know, we tested MagnaCut down there, this year and I had great results, but the tribes were just like, oh, okay, it just looks like metal. You know, they're not like, oh, this is some crazy Excalibur steel or, right. You know, thing along that line. So the MagnaCut, you know, is kind of like the top of the thing when they got to see some MagnaCut knives out there.
And what have you learned from them in terms of what is, well, A, in terms of your knife skills, but also what is desirable or most necessary in a knife that you're going to have, you know, for kind of a do-it-all survival knife?
Yeah, you know, it's for them, it's not necessarily the knife design because you can give them, you know, anything. We brought down, we had a flint knapper bringing obsidian and they showed how they would just use a rock to carve out, you know, different types of fish. So ergonomics is important for long-term stuff. That's definitely something I learned on the Polar North machete. I don't have one near me, but I learned all about the choil spot near the top where, you know, sometimes people like to use a machete very, very easily. And that is a big deal. Let's see here. Oh, I got something.
That's the Topps machete with the sort of long handle, right? If you're looking at it, it looks a little bit like a longer machete handle. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And so I'm starting to look at a lot of machete designs and this one's not necessarily a machete. It's made by a machete company, but I didn't really appreciate, you know, that spot there, so much until lately when I've been watching a lot of the different manipulation that the indigenous would do when they're utilizing blades, such as in this like chef pinch grip, you know, method. And so I pay a lot more attention to that in ergonomics now when I'm designing some larger, you know, heavier tools.
So that knife you have right there looks like it reminds me a little bit of a barong from the Philippines. So I know a lot of the knives that all of the knives that you're experiencing are these. I'm sorry, the name. I know I have some machetes from this Taormina. What is it?
Tramontina. Tramontina.
Okay, Tramontina. Are they from Brazil? I think maybe.
Yeah, but they also have a company in factory in Colombia as well.
Okay.
And then I work for Condor Tool & Knife, whose parent company is Imakasa, which you can see on the blade here, and I might be able to see it right there in that thing. But so they make 40,000 machetes a month.
A month?
Yeah, they're a pretty big deal for machetes. The second biggest machete manufacturer, the leading one would be probably Tramontina.
Wow. My gosh. Well, I know down in South America and Central America, I've been down to Bolivia a couple of times.
Oh, cool.
There's lots of people have machetes. It's just part of what they do and how they work. And, you know, I like that. I like walking around and seeing machetes. Though I've never been in a situation, having someone else having a machete made me feel threatened. I could see where that's a possibility for sure. But, you know, that's not how I see these things.
You know, in the U.S., kind of going to get on a soapbox here. There's, you know, not a lot of love for machetes because machetes are more or less a poor man's, you know, tool. It's in an area where people can't afford, like a John Deere tractor or something. They're on mountains where they can't get the inclines for, different types of tools, or it's just a lesser expensive tool. So when you see it, it's going to be more, threatening, you know, in England where they have much stricter knife laws, you know, when they saw me swinging the machete, they were like, whoa. And, you know, I never really thought that way. So, you know, because I go down to El Salvador and South America and stuff, it's such a machete rich culture that I become jaded and just walk around with machetes all the time because I'm used to them and understand why people have them a lot. So,
well, you can do a lot with it. First of all, we got to talk about that before you put it down. That's wicked cool. But you can do a lot with a big knife that you can't do with a small knife.
Right. Right.
Of course, there are some things you just cannot manage with a knife that size. But
right.
There are most you can, from food mm-hmm. prep to, you know, chopping down a tree. What is this? This thing is amazing looking.
This can do a lot of big knife tasks and some small knife tasks. This is the Mid Makara by Condor Tool and Knife. I designed it this year for 2022. It's a smaller version of the Makara machete, made out of 1075 high carbon steel with a distal taper and nice. Two-handed grip just in case, but actually very lightweight, but more just a type of machete so that you can have a little bit of self-defense related with it, but a lot more usability too, because it still keeps that Latin, you know, curve, that Latin, well, still having a little bit of a Japanese appeal.
Man, I got to say, Joe, this is really beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
And, oh, yeah, you're welcome. And very desirable, especially with the, like you said, it the way the blade widens out, has that sub tip and everything. It has a bit of that Tanto appeal.
But yeah.
At the same time, it looks all business. Like, I mean, work business. Like, you could do a lot in the brush with it. The thing I was going to ask, I don't have it. It's in the other room, but I have the old Golok machete, one of the first,
the Valiant ones. Oh, the old, oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's a beauty. And, but it is thick. It's like, well, it's a quarter inch thick and no distal taper. So it's a beast. It's something you chop, like, it's not for light grass. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. You should see the change in their stuff now, because they've now, you know, distal tapered it, skeletonized it. They know so much more. Sometimes I see some of the original stuff and it's mind blowing.
Oh, I have some other stuff by them too that, like I have their Norse Sax, which is just so cool.
Yeah.
It's a really cool knife. It's my sock drawer knife. No, but they make, what I was going to ask you was this one that you were just holding up. What is the, blade, stock on that?
So this is 1/8 inch thick.
Mm.
Oh, so much thinner. Much more manageable, and has a distal taper to get much thinner. So it's much, much lighter than you'd think. And we tested this out in the Amazon jungle a lot. We really have to make sure that distal taper, is there, because it puts less flexion on the handle. Because if it doesn't have the distal taper there, all that flexion will go to the handle and can create a problem.
Oh, that's interesting. So the fact that it gets thinner towards the tip puts some of the pressure more towards the tip than
the Ricasso.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so you can still do like a full tang and still keep the smashed rivets on there. But of course, I'm going to be researching the heck out of that and having distal tapers of different Golocks out there and things.
So is this available right now?
Yep. This sure is. I believe you can get it off of Knife Center, Blade HQ, most of the knife places here.
All right. How'd you get into this? How did you get into going to the jungle, roughing it, learning all this all these amazing skills?
Well, do you guys know who Essie Knives are?
Yeah.
Well, this actually goes out to them, because this was one of Mike Perrin's original Benchmade AFCKs. And he just recently passed away, but he sent this to me, a while back. And I remember reading about this in, Tactical Knives magazine. That's why I have my own. I don't carry that one, 'cause I don't want to lose it. My own AFCK from back in the day, but I read Tactical Knives magazine a lot and, loved it, you know, as a kid, and, was on the forums a whole lot, you know, in college while I was doing zoology and entomology, and started writing for Tactical Knives magazine itself, because I was outside actually doing stuff. And then I started getting a little bit more popular in the knife world, and one thing led to another. I walked up to Condor Tool and Knife because I really, really liked machetes, and they wanted to hear more about some of my designs. And at the same time, I started talking with Topps Knives and Mike Fuller, who also has passed away, took me in with my first design called the Shango. So between Topps and Condor, kind of started out there from the, you know, newspaper world of knives, and then, you know, worked my way to here. And so there's other designs. I think, let's see here. Topps doesn't make the Shango anymore. They have this guy, the Barakimo, that I designed for Bushcraft Global. This is one of my beaters, so it's all messed up. You should see the one that still smells horrible in the garage. You've got to, like, sanitize everything.
Oh, man.
But
jungle smell?
Yeah, it's great. My wife loves it. So I didn't really, like, go into, you know, the knife world knowing anything about engineering. I just got very, very lucky to be, you know, here where I'm at now. And with Essie, they were the first guys who I went to the jungle with.
Oh, it's Randall.
Yeah, Randall Adventure and Training.
Okay, Randall Adventure and Training, hence RAT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the models. Okay, so you went down with them, and did that spark your love for, I'll just the shorthand, jungle survival?
Yeah, for all intensive purposes, I've got all these bugs, which I love, you know, reptiles everywhere, really big blades and all of that smashed together. And so it was just a natural heaven for me. Plus, I really enjoy heat. You know, I'm scared of cold weather. So it was a natural for me. I did pretty well, I would say, in the jungle down there. I mean, I did just as good as everybody else. And it was a really fun time. So then I happened to be on another expedition where I met Goran of Tanaboca Knives. I met him because he owned this eco reserve. And he knew about this Matisse tribe who he hangs out with. And I was like, okay, well, I can bring people down here and we can do some survival stuff with some of the other tribes. He's like, okay, let's do it. And so that's kind of how Bushcraft Global formed.
Oh, right.
I have cuts all over my body right now from it.
Cuts, you mean from going through bramble and that kind of thing?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Everything down there. It's just, you just get abraded.
Everything's trying to kill you down there, basically, right? Or maybe not on purpose, but
yeah,
doesn't have something specific against you, but
you
survival
know,
is hard.
This was one of the safest trips, even though we had the most dangerous animals around us. Nobody except for Goran Tanaboca got bit. And we tell people, you know, the scariest thing is that people want to live down there after they're down there. It's just so resource abundant that, like, you can't help but being pulled in.
What is the weirdest thing you've experienced in the jungle?
Let's see. There's a bunch. I would say possibly being stalked by a jaguar. Yeah, I didn't believe it until he showed me what he said were footprints in my footprints. But we were out there, me and Yukuna tribesman. He was looking for monkeys, and all of a sudden the whole entire jungle gets quiet. You know, I turn on my GoPro and thinking I'm going to get some cool footage. He goes, take out your machete. You know, it's just going to tick off the blowgun will just tick off the jaguar. Okay, so then he pulls out a leaf and starts doing a little toucan sound, and the whole entire jungle gets dead quiet. It's like, oh man. And then about like 5 minutes later, it just gets loud again. He goes, okay, it's gone. And I'm like, come on, man, there was something here. What was it? He goes, possibly jaguar just smelled us and ran away and walked around us. And I was like, no way. And so he comes and shows me a footprint, and there was like some kind of paw print indentation there. He's like, there it is. And I believed him. So then we got back to camp, and he's explaining to Goran. He goes, it was either a jaguar or El Duende, which is like this forest gnome creature down there. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, why El Duende? And he goes, oh, because the ground looked like it was swept. It's just like weirdest thing ever.
That is funny. El Duende. That is a there's a whole family joke that I won't get into here that revolves around El Duende, because I'm married to a Bolivian woman.
Oh, okay.
And El Duende was a thing that they scared them with when they were little.
yeah. There's a lot of that down there, which actually comes into knife work too.
What do you mean?
They got something called a cordipeda, And there's different tribes with different renditions of this monster. This isn't actually the Cordipeta, but this is, if you can imagine, a mask that they would make to symbolize each of the gods or each of the monsters. But there's a creature called the Cordipeta down there. It's kind of like a Bigfoot. Oh, he's okay. Got his legs turned around backwards so that when you think he's coming after you, you think he's running away. And like he's this rapey Bigfoot guy who like gets you really lost. And so if you think you're getting lost in the jungle, you have to sit, basically do the stop thing, which is stop, think, observe, and plan, where you sit, you think, you carve this little puzzle with your knife. So you take out your knife and you're working this crazy little puzzle and going back and forth. And it forces you to think about your situation and where you're at. And you make this little crazy trap puzzle that's all really, really odd that folds back together. And you put it on the trail. And then you're ready to go home because it traps the Cordipeta and he starts looking at it, trying to figure out how it works. And they got a bunch of these little traps that are all knife and machete work that kind of teach you to do that. It's really neat to see that kind of like survival attitude, you know, put into a mythical cryptozoology critter.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's a great way to teach kids all those skills too. It's like,
yeah,
hey man, if you want to get stalked by El Duende while you're out there, or if you want to stop the Cordipeta from chasing you down, you carve this little parlor trick, and he picks it up and he's a wild man of the forest and he can't figure this thing
yeah,
out.
Yeah, yeah. There's like leaves that aren't split that like dangle together and all of this other really like technical stuff. I've got some videos at some point I can send you.
Cool.
They're pretty incredible. But, you know, that's just like one way, you know, cultures are using knives all the time. And I think that really, really excites me and really interests me to see that around the world.
So what lessons have you learned from your experiences down there and the time you've spent down there that you can or that you're bringing back up here for people to sort of normalize more and more knife enthusiasm, ownership, you know, excitement. I know Knife Rights does a lot in terms of the legal thing, but there are also, I feel like, social hurdles that can always be overcome. Is there anything that you've garnered from living down there and spending time down there that can be imported up here?
Yeah, you know, it's really actually an interest of mine to see, you know, blade use anthropologist-wise, there's a woman who records young kids, like very young, like age 3, 4, using machetes just like their parents. And so they've got videos of this, and this lady is showing, you know, what we would consider something crazy. So when you see people using some of these, you know, tools and knives and stuff, it makes you realize, hey, you know, getting out there and really learning how to use a tool, almost is more important than what blade you're using itself. And it's like that old saying, it's not the bow, it's the archer. You know, these guys can do amazing things with, you know, broken pieces of glass, and it's very humbling.
As someone who, you know, by comparison is just a rabid materialist collecting knives because
me too.
I just, good. It makes me feel, I don't know what the word is. Maybe, I don't know, but I see these guys surviving and doing, not just surviving, just living and thriving, mm-hmm. And using their knives all the time. And I wish this is going to sound crazy, but I kind of wish that for my knives too. It's like, I have this collection of knives that sits fallow a lot of the time. And
yeah.
I wish I were out there using them and pushing them and get my money's worth out of them other than just that enjoyment of like owning art.
Yeah. You know, and I feel that especially from writing, you know, I've got probably 3,000 knives behind me in drawers too. And a lot of them are safe queens, you know, so it feels like, I'm doing a disservice, but, you know, they are pieces of metal with the story. So there is, you know, that sentimental balance you have with some of the stuff. And even, you know, like, the Condor Pterosaur, you know, you can get it for like $40. And, there was a really beat up one down in South America. And I was just like, man, I've got to have this. I got to have this. Harry, one of the tribesmen, let me buy it from you. And he would not sell it to me, even for twice as much, because you become attached to some of these things, even if they're, you know, beat up and all that. But it's okay to have like 50 of them. I've got so many.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I like hearing that. I like the number 3,000. Hopefully you weren't exaggerating, because it makes me feel better.
No, I mean, look at this. This AFCK has barely been used.
Yeah.
So it's you know, and then I've got a prototype too. That's not going to get used at all.
Oh my God. Oh, that is awesome.
Oh, this is my prototype. Not
Can I see it? No, I know. Can we see it though?
This is the Condor Wendigo.
Very nice. Speaking of cryptozoology.
Yeah. There you go. And you can see that the blade is a little bit too high here. And trying to do like a Scandi blade, and this is a knife podcast, so I'm like, oh, I don't even have to rehearse anything. Already get into it. Because it's more like a pocket knife, you know, you don't want that thin of an edge on there. So I saw some stuff in the prototype form that we had to change for the grind, but there's prototype in action.
So which the grind on top is the more desirable one, is that right?
Yeah, it's the new one. We went a little bit high with this.
So that doesn't, the high one, I'm sorry, gives you too shallow an angle for a proper Scandinavian grind? Is that?
Yeah, or, you know, just a very, very thin edge that you have to watch out for. Oh, here's a test for my GoPro camera. You might be able to see a chip.
Oh, yeah. There. Yeah, I can see it.
And that was done during heavier wood testing, you know, right off the bat. So, you know, they're Condor is trying to learn how to do folding knives, and this is like their second folding knife that they've done. They're really trying to dial it in now.
I think it's an admirable pursuit. It's like Tops.
Yeah.
You know, they spent a long time kind of in R&D, and they'd say, oh, we're going to come out. You know, they had a couple of aluminum tactical knives, which were cool, but when they were really penetrating the bushcraft market with the Brothers of Bushcraft knife at that period of time, they started coming out with the folding version of their 2.5 neck knife. Mm-hmm. And it was like it took them a long time, and they made promises and they had to break them. And I respected that, because it's like, we're not going to put out something until it's ready. And you can see that happening with Condor. Here, I have a question for you, and you are the perfect person to ask. What is the benefit of a Scandi grind?
So Scandi grinds are great for fast sharpening, where you can just get an edge very, very fast. It's great for woodworking. It's okay for meat processing and other type of processing and stuff. But for a lot of bushcrafters, they love Scandi grinds, because it penetrates wood, you know, a lot more. So these Scandi grinds are able to take off large chunks of wood while you're working.
I'm sorry, let me just interrupt. If you're unfamiliar, it's Scandinavian grind, and it's basically a zero. The bevel is the edge.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, just in case anyone.
And the other cool part is that people don't really talk about much is that Scandi grinds can be customizable. If you need to put more, you know, meat behind the edge, you can micro bevel it and strop it and make it a little bit harder. If you have to get it super thin, you can really work it very easily on like a diamond stone to get just the type of edge that you'd like. And if you need to, you can modify it and make it a secondary bevel really quick if you're going to be doing heavy stuff around bone. So that's why Scandi stuff is popular.
That's cool. I did not even think of that, about how you can adjust the type of edge you want. I remember when the Brothers of Bushcraft knife came out, I believe it was that knife. People got their, well, I can't say that. People got upset because, the Scandi grind has a micro bevel.
Yes,
it's not a true Scandi, you know, and people got a little upset about that. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was, probably scandal. One of the lead guys to convince them to go to, Scandinavian grinds. Cool. And was one of the Brothers of Bushcraft guys. But the problem was, it would be, with the thickness that they first started with the Scandinavian grind, they couldn't get it just right. And the other problem is a lot of people don't know how to take care of a proper, perfect Scandinavian grind. I've even been to LT Wright's, Scandinavian grind class up in Ohio, and, they put micro bevels on theirs. About the only company who doesn't is Mora of Sweden. So the secondary bevel is, you know, pretty important. Let's see here. I've got a, this is a pretty classic knife, not my design. A Skookum. One of my favorite knife designs out there. This one's by Rob Garcia. And if you look very closely, it's developed a secondary bevel. So that sometimes happens because you know, and you keep it very thin, you're going to have a chunked out, you know, Scandi edge unless you keep it perfect all the time. And, you know.
Yes. Yes. I only have very small smattering. As a matter of fact, it was 2-1 because I gave my, Bush lore to a friend's son who camps. I was like, well, here, take this because you'll use it and I don't. But the remaining Scandi blade I have is over there. That's why I'm looking over there. It's one of the old red-handled Moras.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
I love that old knife with the single quillion down. And that's kind of a shop knife. This room doubles as like a do-everything room. And I have noticed that because I've really tried desperately to maintain that perfect Scandi edge. And I thought it was something I was doing, but yeah, it's getting all chipped up. And I think it's because it's lacking that secondary edge.
Yeah. I've got like a bag of 30 or 40 Moras that I use for classes that have chipped up edges, because they don't have that secondary bevel. Let's see. This one doesn't have it. I know I've got one probably chipped here. But even the Skookum has tiny little microchips, you know, in it as well. So, you know, there is some cases where Scandi might not be so desirable. This pterosaur is a Fiddleback Forge pterosaur with a very high flat grind. And that's also very, very applicable for wood carving and a little bit stronger, too. And you'll see that in some Topps knives and Condor knives and Becker knives as well, like the BK9 has a very high grind with the secondary bevel.
Man, just looking at that Fiddleback Forge, this is such beautiful knives they make.
Yeah, so this is like variations on the Pterosaur, which is one of Condor's more popular knives.
Yeah, but that's your design, right?
Yeah. So this is 2008, 2009, with Fiddleback Forge, Off the Map, custom knives. And then this one's by Andy Roy of Fiddleback Forge. And that was around 2010 as well. So that's those versions. And then this one is the Condor polypropylene handled version.
Oh, cool.
So you can kind of see the progression. And when they came and asked me for one of their, polyprop, I'm not doing a good job here, cameraman. I'm sorry. When they're trying to do like they wanted the polypropylene knife that was like very, very, robust. I was like, all right, this one's tried and, you know, proven. I also have a dogwood, pterosaur as well. He just came down on the trip.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It's actually all funky in the garage too, but, Dogwood Custom Knives is a knife maker.
Yeah. We just had him on the show.
Ah, excellent. Cool.
Yeah.
So he went down for his like seventh time down there and just came back too. And he was testing LMAX as well.
I saw him on Instagram getting beaten with reeds or something like that.
Yeah, that's the Medivine ceremony. That's a ceremony that the Matisse tribe does, but they need knives, you know, in order to do it.
Yeah.
A lot of the rituals there are based on pain. To get you through some of the hardships of the jungle. And so that's one of the rituals that you'll see like on different, production magazines and things like that.
It reminded me a little bit of one of those Russian massages you see in mob movies. Jim was just, scrolling through a webpage with a bunch of knife designs.
Yeah. And sorry about the website, guys, by the way, it sucks.
No. Don't worry about that. I mean, it's sort of a known that people spend a lot more time designing and making knives than they do with their website. But it looked like an entire line of related knives with some really nice designs. That Scotia knife looks like a Canadian belt knife to me.
Cool. That Mayflower is actually a collaboration
Nice.
Between Charles May and myself. should say it. Oh, it should say it somewhere on there. I'll find it later. But he was sitting around the campfire. I was like, Joe, we have to collaborate on something. Why? Mayflower. So
nice.
Really cool. Awesome custom knife maker. Charles May Knives.
Charles May. Okay. So are these knives all available? Are these things that... Okay. Oh, man. So who produces these?
So El Salvador produces Condor. They're kind of like the company I'm like the most loyal to because they helped me get started. And Tops, of course, is made in the U.S. Every once in a while, we might have to get parts from different other countries. I also designed for CJRB and Artisan Cutlery. They're actually made in China. I really wanted to work with powder steel. And so their proprietary powder steel was kind of like 440C, but like on supercharged power.
Yeah, the AR-RPM-9. That's an awesome steel. I love that stuff.
It's been performing great. You know, I'm like a user. I'm not going to sit there all day long and try and get 100s on my Sharp device over there.
Yeah.
But I can fix it in the field, which is really important to me. And I think that's what's actually the best part about this.
Let's talk about this design for a second. Mm-hmm. I was watching videos right after Blade Show where you were talking about this. And also, there's another one that I want to talk about, too, that you have coming out from CJRB. But tell me a little bit about this design. You mentioned in that video that you used this a lot. You tested it a lot down in the jungle. But to look at it, it's a much more high speed. I mean, it kind of looks like a... Kind of looks like an Italian racing boat, you know?
Yeah.
But it's got the cutting edge has the lines of, you know, a machete, a barong, something that's reaching downward. So you're getting that sort of efficient angle. Tell me about the design of this. It just seems very different.
Yeah. So he wanted something, Russell from Artisan wanted something that was very lightweight and very Joe, which is kind of funny because I, you know, designed so many different things. It's hard to have one type of style, but there are ways they could do things that some of the other companies I've worked for weren't really able to in the budget range that we wanted to. So like bevels and different types of ornate back handle designs. That's where it came from. For the bevel, it's eye catching. You'll see a lot of movie knives have big bevels like the Rambo.
Are you talking about the big, the Fuller there?
Yeah, the Fuller, blood groove, you know, not bevel. I meant to say, Fuller. But it's also to take out weight. It's got a very high hollow grind, almost flat grind, if not flat. I think it actually is flat. I've looked at it with my, flat thing over there and tested it. If it's like a hollow grind, it's like a wheel that's like this big. But it's very, very high, so it's still able to bite in the wood. It hasn't really fractured that much, even with some of the harder woods out there. And then the handle is skeletonized. What this one has, the actual skeletonization is made into tools. The ones with the handle do not have that, but they do have big holes and channels to take out weight. And it's very, very, very thin. So the whole idea was so that it can be put on like a vest or around a belt or underneath the hip belt on a backpack where it won't like gouge into somebody. And in the ARPM-9 steel, you can have it on your waistband of your like shorts when you're out in the water and there's no problem.
I call them pajama knives. Six-blade knives you can get. Yeah. This to me looks great because it's so thin and I carry a fixed blade in the waistband at 3 o'clock and I have a very suburban lifestyle. So this looks like it would, nestle in, quite nicely being so thin. And then looking at it, I was looking at that Fuller differently. I mean, I know it's weight relief, but I was thinking also, like the I-beam effect. Does that add rigidity? And for the kind of stuff you design knives for, these kind of hardcore tasks, would that rigidity come in handy? I was thinking that might be structural.
It could be that whole I-beam. I'm not an engineer. That whole I-beam argument has a lot of pros and cons. It would be structural in the fact that, once again, I'm not an engineer, but it could either be like a point where it's going to take a lot of the shock away, but that's again why the The back of the handle is skeletonized. So as far as structure goes, it's been fine with light batoning. You know, we haven't sat there and tried to multiply stab, you know, like a brick wall. But yeah, if the structural thing holds up, which I'm always, you know, apprehensive about, then definitely.
And the pommel has that weird notch. What is that? Is that a tool?
Yeah, it was supposed to be originally sized for a pocket rocket stove, but we had to change it up a little bit. So now it's like a different way to open up a bottle, or just a notch for doing different things where you use a notch. I don't know how to explain it, but even like lighting paracord and then pulling it through that, you can get like small little thin threads to thread through buttons and things. You just start using all the stuff that's on there. So it did have like a better idea, but it's turned into that.
Well, naturally, my mind went to bottle opener, and then I thought, what other uses? And yeah, I was thinking like, you know, the wire stripper on a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah,
comes in handy for a lot of stuff.
And we wanted to have that pommel on the back that you normally see with you know, machetes out there. So that way, you know, it has a little bit of a Joe flair because machetes. But also you can grab it with maybe mittens on a little bit easier, or pull it out if it's like a neck knife, just a little bit easier, and to give you just a little bit more purchase, to really make it, you know, a good 4-inch-ish, you know, bushcrafting or outdoor blade or even tactical blade.
Yeah.
The black one looks sweet.
Oh, all black. So, and then there's a Kephart and,
yeah,
and Rex Applegate walk into a bar and
yeah,
this is what comes out.
So this is so, you know, cool. when you're designing knives, you know, just to make sure you don't get in a rut. Sometimes I learned from Ken Onion one time at Blade Show, you know, sometimes it's fun to design a story, you know, instead of, you know, just going ahead and designing a knife. And one night I was just thinking, you know, combinations of people at bars. And so Rex Applegate and Horace Kephart, you know, and I got to touch Horace Kephart's actual knife. So it's pretty special to be able to incorporate that with a refreshing look on the design. And we used this down in the jungle this year. It did great. The Matisse didn't screw it up. So I'm pretty happy with it as well.
For those who might need a refresher, who are Rex Applegate and Horace Kephart?
Horace Kephart is kind of like the grandfather of the Great Smoky Mountains. He was a very big writer back in the early 1920s. Wrote for Field and Stream, had his own knife design, had a couple of other things out there. Came out with the book Woodcraft and Camping. And Colonel Rex Applegate, is the, kind of one of the guys behind the Fairbairn, style fighting knives that are out there. Wrote the book, I believe, Kill or Be Killed, book on knife fighting. So, you know, knife fighting guru guy. And so that's kind of where the idea comes from.
So you got this beautiful dagger shape, but it's also the cutting edge, of a Kephart. Yep. I think it's I love it. I love it because, well, I love daggers, and I happen to be on a little dagger tear right now.
Oh, excellent.
as one does. But this, yeah, is very, very appealing to me because, it's got the, you know, I definitely love weapons, and it has the weapon-y appeal, but then it also is purely practical too. And knowing that it was in the hands of the Matisse and you and other, you know, experts in the jungle and being used. And it's not just an interesting story. That's the best part.
Yeah. You know, this steel, there are so many new steels out there, man. I can't keep up with them. Now Spyderco's got H2, which I can't wait to try out and all this, but I've been really impressed with all powder steels that I've had so far. It's just neat stuff.
So how do you find that through practical use it differs from, say, you know, 1095 or a 154 cm if we're talking stainless?
Oh, man. It almost depends on the steel, because some of them don't like to even be stropped. Some of them like to have like more of a toothy edge to work, like H1 I just learned. It seems like it's less toothy and keeps more of a of an edge that doesn't bind on wood, and I barely do any carving out there. This is just like, okay, carving just to carve to see what would happen. I'm actually not a great craftsman out there. It stays, polished sharp, I guess would be the way to say it. It's not like binding like some of the more higher carbon steels.
Okay. So, is this the, Rexhart. Mm-hmm. So, the Rexhart, and so are they both available now?
Yes. The Rexhart just started shipping now. Okay. And the other one is called the Hyperlite. Yeah, I feel like one of those flea market people peddling their wares.
One of those late night shows.
And this one, Abner, is...
Joe, can I get 70 of both of those for, like, say, $29? Can
you send them? Okay, yes, thank coming you. Straight from... And we'll put a... We'll get a free bandana, too, I swear.
You promise? So, what are the... So, everyone, just take note, both of those knives are live. So you can not only... get Joe Flowers designs from Condor, plenty of them, and Tops. Mm-hmm. By the way, I was looking at your Condor Bowie the other night. Cool. Other night, really beautiful. And Tops, but also now CJRB/artisan.
Yep, and Work Tough Cutlery here in the near future, and hopefully some other stuff too.
Work Tough.
Yeah.
They are so cool. I got to find out more about them.
They're pretty cool. You know, that company, it's neat because, you know, everybody's like, I'm not going to get into sentiments or politics or anything like that, but, you know, everybody's like, oh, it's another, you know, Asian knife company. And it's like, no, this company was started by a guy who was a huge knife fan, first, and then happened to be in Taiwan and started this knife company. So he was a knife nut first who started this company, not wanting to start a company and then, you know, get into knives.
And then got savvy. Right.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that either, right. Frankly. But so, yeah, that's exciting. But where are you taking this? What do you want to do what do you want to do with your life, young man? No, what do you want to do in terms of knife designs? How do you want to expand your knife involvement?
Well, you know, trying to do more design work for other companies is always nice. A couple of other ones I'm going to try and go for, but also trying to learn, you know, more about knife making, knife use, and even just taking classes all around the U.S. when I can. That's kind of next step, is to really understand why, you know, behind making some of these designs and things. That's not just in the U.S. too. I'd like to go to Nepal and find out about the Krukeries and go to Indonesia and, of course, go praying crazy. So, you know, that's the next step, is going to the cultures where they're, you know, small area, South America, you know, where people are using all these blades every day. And I want to see, you know, other places around the world, what kind of cool stuff they can teach.
Oh man. It's a rich environment out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Best of luck to you, in that regard. And we will check back in with you. How can people check in with you, follow your exploits?
So, my website will be getting updated. Sorry, guys. But mostly on, Instagram, Facebook, Bushcraft Global, YouTube, when we get around to it, really doing a lot of stuff right now, rather than trying to, you know, do the, promotion thing. So Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, probably TikTok here in the near future, because everybody seems to be going that route. And all that stuff too. And then, of course, bushcraftglobal@gmail.com.
And don't forget Condor, Blade HQ, yeah, and Knife Center and everywhere that sells your designs.
Yeah, of course. So condortk.com, Tops Knives, all of the big knife places, Smoky Mountain Knife Works, they're having rep weekend coming up. So a lot of the knife guys will be out there. So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff, you know, coming up. Georgia Bushcraft. If you guys like knives and you want to see knives getting used, come down to Georgia Bushcraft. It's a huge event, like up to 500 people, this November, georgiabushcraft.com.
Right on. Well, Joe, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No problem.
It's been a real pleasure meeting you and
absolutely
talking about everything. I hope to see you back here sometime soon.
Absolutely.
Welcome back stateside, sir.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being on here. Thank you so much. Where can we find out more about Knife Junkie Podcasts?
TheKnifeJunkie.com, of course, is a good place to start. And YouTube, Facebook, Twitch, and all the podcast apps.
Do you have a Patreon too?
Oh, we do. TheKnifeJunkie.com/Patreon. Awesome. Thank you, Joe. Look at that.
I'm just getting into learning about these Patreon things. I joined Ed's manifestos and was really impressed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's cool. All righty, sir. Have a great one. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Ever strop a knife again, even though it gets no real use? Face up to what you are. You're a knife junkie.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Joe Flowers learned a lot in the last hour. Very interesting, man. I got to say, in that intro, I said adventuring vicariously through him. And now I'm going to light out for the territories, I think. Anyway, it was a real pleasure talking with him. Be sure to join us on Wednesday for the midweek supplemental and Thursday for Thursday Night Knives, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. Until next time. For Jim working his magic behind the switcher, my name is Bob DeMarco, begging you, do not take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487 and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.